You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the February 2022 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part A. Here's the continuation of Becoming by Lucy Santi. In those days, I was spending unreasonable amounts of time taking selfies and gender-swapping them on the app. I had just gotten back one that I thought looked plausibly enough like me as a woman that I could show it to everyone and they would immediately understand. Note, I can no longer see the resemblance. That was the tack I decided to try with M. She'd think it was cute. Maybe that would soften the shock. The day after my session with Dr. G, I pulled it out after dinner. She was confused. What was I showing her? Well, it's me as a woman. Huh? I explained. She didn't see the resemblance, but she listened. I told her about my dark secret and how I had kept it hidden for upwards of 55 years and how it had suddenly come bursting out of my chest like the alien in Alien. She was taken aback, but she was moved. She offered support and encouragement, praised me through all my early awkward attempts at presenting as female, gave me a jazzy 1970s striped wrap skirt. Sometime later, though, she said, I can think of you as my romantic partner or as a woman, and it seems more important that I think of you as a woman. My heart fell to my feet. We were no longer a couple. A major reason for my long repression was my fear of losing women, who, beginning in late adolescence, had constituted 3/4 of my closest friends, as well as all my romantic interest. I thought they'd be repelled by my presumption. I did tend to put women on a pedestal. That didn't happen with M, but I had failed as a romantic partner to someone who meant the world to me, and that was almost as bad. I spent months in misery around M, becoming furtive once more, hiding my new clothes as they arrived in the mail, only presenting once or twice a week, despite the pleasure and affirmation it gave me, mulishly somehow trying to have it both ways. My bouts of dysphoria were further colored by the idea that I was a failed heterosexual man, and I experienced major discomfort around my usual social set, primarily made up of heterosexual couples. But I still had to acknowledge that gender dysphoria, in its more general sense, explained a few hundred mysteries about my personality. I didn't realize how uncomfortable I was in my body until I started transitioning and suddenly felt comfortable. This with no reference to primary or secondary sexual characteristics. I had been clenched, off balance, prickly, never knowing how to stand or what to do with my hands, because I was unconsciously guarding against postures and expressions that might read as too femme. I didn't know how to act as a man. I hated sports and dick jokes and beer chugging and the way men talked about women. My idea of hell was an evening with a bunch of guys. Over the years, from force of necessity, I created a male persona that was saturnine, cerebral, a bit remote, a bit owlish, possibly quirky, coming very close to asexual despite my best intentions. I was endlessly lovelorn and had only a handful of successful liaisons. I had little priapic drive, and I had always kept people at a distance. For 14 years, M served as my social shield. I made her do all the reaching out, all the casting of plans, because at bottom, I was terrified of people, even close friends of 40 or 50 years. Confiding fully in anyone was impossible because it might lift my iron curtain. Back in late adolescence, during the most drug-intensive period of my life, I had two intensely bad trips on LSD. The first, during my senior year of high school, was bad because I was afraid of being transgender, afraid I'd be sucked in by it and never return. The second, during my first year of college, went dark because I was scared that something I'd say or do would reveal to the people I was tripping with that I was transgender. In the first week of March, I came out to my inner circle, some 20 people. Everyone was supportive, although a few were clearly poleaxed. Some had always thought there was something off about me. A few swore they'd guessed closer to the truth. Three women friends wrote that they had happy tears in their eyes. I began to plan my coming out in widening rings. A second group of friends in May. In July, the faculty and administration of the college where I teach. Instagram and the wider world in September. Along the way, I began to hear from people I hadn't seen in decades, who maybe learned about my transition third hand. Nobody gave me any guff, although I was fully braced for it. Somehow, I found myself receiving unexpected affirmation from unexpected quarters. Now, 9 months into hormone replacement therapy, I can see significant changes in my face and body, although the sightings can be fleeting and may not be visible to anyone else. The beautiful image I sometimes see in the mirror is immediately undone if I try to take a picture. But I am much happier than I can remember being, more centered, many, many times more social. A few years before my transition, I had undertaken to sell my papers to the New York Public Library and realized, dimly, that I was preparing for death. Now I want to put off the final curtain for as long as possible. I don't know what it means to be a woman, of course. Yes, I am binary, but that is simply because of the amalgamation of cultures I come from. I've gotten much more relaxed about a host of things. I've decided not to mess with my voice, which is my instrument. I no longer wear padded bras. I wear little makeup. I take no interest in how I am viewed by passers-by. I am unconcerned about being misgendered. I don't particularly care about pronouns. Some of this is due to the influence of my trans mother, Elle, with whom I've spent a great deal of quality time walking public streets and being visible in public places. Elle, all of 24 years old, has somehow acquired wisdom far beyond her years. She is as bored as I am with the discourse that afflicts the trans community. Its stifling rules of language, its micro-territoriality, its insipid bromides. We realize that we are flying into the unknown, that the more we learn, the more we realize we don't know, that gender is a concatenation of physical, mental, emotional, and cultural factors we will never master, because no one does. Most of the time, I feel normal in my new identity. I walk the dog, go to the hardware store and the supermarket, COVID mask help in the more fraught circumstances, teach class, take the train or the bus, go out for dinner with friends, give public readings, all without trepidation. The existential crisis I feared from my dependence on a wig, male pattern baldness, has decimated my noggin since I was 17. When I thought it was divine punishment for my yearnings, did not happen. I can't sleep or shower in the wig, but other than that, it has simply become my hair. I am generally at peace, patching up my sorrows and white-knuckling through my fears, although now and then I am transfixed by the deep strangeness of it all. Here I am, at 67 years of age, undertaking something enormous that should have been done decades ago. Certain changes are superficial, but others are metaphysical. earlier in my transition, I felt this tidal shift acutely. I experienced awe and dread. I spent entire days literally quaking. Now I am aware that I live, as we all do, in a cloud of unknowing, where certainties break down and categories become liquid. None of us really knows anything, except provisionally. Now, as Lou Reed put it, I'm set free to find a new illusion. What lies beneath. In 1708, the Spanish galleon San Jose sank in a deadly battle against English warships, taking with it billions in treasure. Centuries passed before a secretive archaeologist found the wreck, but now nations are again warring over who may claim the gold and glory by Julian Sancton, with illustrations by Yuko Shimizu. Opening illustration shows many old wooden ships out on the water, flying their various flags of origin, and one being sunk and in flames. June 8, 1708. The Count of Casa Alegre knew a squadron of English warships was lurking in the area, but he thought he could avoid it. As captain of the Spanish galleon San Jose, he was charged with leading the Tierra Firma fleet from the Caribbean back to Spain. 17 ships in all, loaded with several years' worth of treasure from the New World. Enough, perhaps, to turn the tide of war in Europe. Casa Alegre had no doubt the English would be after the precious cargo. If he could reach the harbor of Cartagena de Indias on the coast of what is now Colombia, the fleet would be safe. Then they appeared on the horizon to the north, 4 English sails. To give the fleet's merchant ships a chance to reach the harbor, Casa Alegre had no choice but to turn and fight. He hoisted the red battle flag up the mainmast and sailed toward the enemy, accompanied by 2 armed galleons. As in a bar brawl, the 2 most fearsome combatants sought each other out. At sunset, the 70-gun HMS Expedition, helmed by Commodore Charles Wager, took on the 62-gun San Jose. For more than an hour, they traded broadsides, sailing past each other while firing their cannons at close range, pulverizing wood and bone. What happened next is unclear. Night had fallen, and the air was thick with smoke and the smell of gunpowder. Bellowed commands, screams of agony, and bursts of cannon fire resonated across the water. The English heard a powerful explosion from deep within the San Jose and felt the heat of the blast. A fire broke out on the ship, and soon the Spanish side went silent. By the time the smoke cleared, the galleon was gone. All that was left was a field of flotsam onto which fewer than a dozen young sailors clung for life. It had sunk in a matter of minutes. Wager did not consider the battle a victory, but a devastating failure. As the flagship, the San Jose carried far more silver, gold, emeralds, and pearls than any of the merchant vessels. Wager's prize had slipped his grasp, and its treasure now gilded the seabed at unknowable depths, along with the bodies of Casa Alegre and almost 600 of his men. In the 3 centuries since, the San Jose has become a myth. Its legend is built upon gold, which does not oxidize. A gold coin will shine as brightly after 500 years on the ocean floor as the day it was minted. So, too, in the imagination. The luster of gold from the New World entranced explorers, from Columbus to Hernan Cortes, who is said to have told Montezuma's messenger, "I and my companions suffer from a disease of the heart, which can only be cured with gold." That craving didn't abate with time. In Gabriel Garcia Marquez's novel, Love in the Time of Cholera, the lovelorn protagonist, Florentino Ariza, is stricken with an overwhelming desire to salvage the sunken treasure of the San Jose, so that Fermina Tassa, his beloved, could bathe in showers of gold. Colombia's most celebrated author, Garcia Marquez, valued the treasure at 500 billion pesos in the currency of the day, a magical realist embellishment. Since no manifest has been found, historians can only guess at the amount of silver and gold coins the galleon carried on its final voyage, including contraband, perhaps 7 million to 12 million pesos, believed by many to be worth more than $10 billion in today's money. Regularly referred to as the Holy Grail of shipwrecks, the San Jose had been the object of several extensive searches over the decades, becoming only more legendary the longer it remained undiscovered. And then, on December 4, 2015, Colombian President Juan Manuel Santos sent the following tweet: "Great news! We found the galley in San Jose. Tomorrow I will give the details at a press conference from Cartagena. The next day, at the naval base in Cartagena, an exultant Santos touted the discovery as one of the most important in the history of humanity and promised to build a great museum to house the contents of the galleon. He said the search was a joint effort between the government of Colombia and an international team of scientists of the highest level. But he offered no specifics. Everything having to do with the San Jose, he said, was classified, including the coordinates of the wreck. Elected in 2010, Santos had two grand objectives as president, say people familiar with his thinking. One was to end the war with the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, or FARC, the Marxist guerrilla group that had terrorized the Colombian countryside since the 1960s. The other was to find and excavate the fabled San Jose. Santos won the Nobel Peace Prize in 2016 for securing the FARC's surrender. Success with the San Jose would prove more elusive. If he had hoped the discovery would be an unadulterated, legacy-cementing triumph, the passions unleashed in the wake of the announcement would quickly disabuse him of the notion. Next illustration shows some broken pottery jars with coins and jewelry spilling out from them. More than 300 years after its sinking, the San Jose has become embroiled in a battle of a different kind, no less vicious, involving international high finance, treasure hunters, archaeologists, accusations of corruption, and elaborate conspiracy theories. At stake is not just a nation's ransom in riches, but an archaeological godsend. As long as it is excavated with an eye towards science rather than lucre, the wreck can deepen our understanding of a period of colonial history that helped shape the Western Hemisphere. In a radio interview shortly after his announcement, Santos offered tantalizing clues about the person behind the discovery of the San Jose. "I will tell you the tale," he teased. During a consular event outside the country, he recalled, Santos had been accosted by a man who looked like Hemingway, with white hair and a white beard. The man had asked the president for 2 minutes of his time and offered him a framed copy of a large antique map. "He told me, 'This map is not known to anyone,' said Santos. 'This site,' he showed me the site, 'does not appear on any other map, and that site almost guarantees that I know where the galleon is.'" Santos, who had been a sailor in his youth and made no secret of his love for the ocean, clearly relished the swashbuckling quality of the story. But when the interviewer pressed for more details, Santos allowed only that the mystery man is not a treasure hunter, he's not after money, and he genuinely has an anthropological, historical, and cultural vocation. Questions abounded in the weeks that followed. Whoever Hemingway was, he had determined the search area, found the financing, and gotten into the president's head. But who was bankrolling his operation? How much did it cost? Who stood to benefit? Was Colombia selling off its cultural patrimony? Was it even Colombia's to sell? Since the wreck had reportedly been found west of Cartagena in Colombian waters, Santos believed his government had the strongest claim to the galleon and its contents. Within days of Santos's announcement, Spain's Minister of Culture offered his country's cooperation in salvaging the wreck, while also invoking the principle of sovereign immunity, according to which a warship sailing under a nation's flag remains that nation's property even after it has sunk, regardless of how much time has passed. The Spanish Foreign Minister, José Manuel García Margallo, issued a blunter warning. "If this cannot be resolved on friendly terms," he told the press, Colombia must understand that we will claim it and defend our rights. Santos didn't back down. There are a lot of owners who are now popping up, he said at the time. No, sir, this is the Colombian people's cultural heritage. Rattling the ghost of the Spanish Empire has long been a winning political strategy in Latin America, so there was little incentive for Santos to give in. But what of other claims from Spain's former colonies? Most of the gold and silver on board was loaded onto the San Jose in Panama and had been mined in what is now Peru and Bolivia. Peru had sued for its right to sunken Spanish gold before, arguing that colonists had stolen it from the land's previous occupants. What was to stop it from doing so again? The most troublesome claim, however, came not from a foreign government, but rather from the North American treasure hunters who contended that they had already located the wreck 34 years earlier and were entitled to half its value. More than 8,000 Spanish vessels are believed to have been lost during the colonial era between 1492 and the early 19th century. Sinking in battle, as the San Jose did, was rare. Most were dashed against reefs during storms. If their wrecks could be located, the Spanish did their best to salvage them. They usually forced enslaved or indigenous divers to carry out the highly dangerous task. The wrecks they couldn't get to, too deep or too dispersed, remained inaccessible until the second half of the 20th century. Modern underwater treasure hunting was born in the 1950s, following the development of practical scuba equipment and survey technology. What began as a hobbyist pursuit had by the 1970s become a sub-aquatic gold rush, involving mostly American adventurers like Mel Fisher and Burt Weber, who each discovered Spanish treasure they claimed was worth hundreds of millions of dollars. It was in this context that, in 1979, a pair of New York-area stockbrokers named Jim Bannigan and Jim Maloney founded a company called Glucomora to search for the San Jose. In a distinctly 70s touch, their investors included the actor Michael Landon of Little House on the Prairie and disgraced Nixon advisor and Watergate mastermind John Ehrlichman. Glucomora secured a permit from Colombia's main maritime authority, Dirección General Marítima, to search a 1,100 square kilometer area off Cartagena. The first two phases of the search were conducted from a surface vessel equipped with side-scan sonar and a remotely operated vehicle, ROV, to identify any man-made objects on the seafloor. The team found a single cannon and located a few possible targets, but ran out of money before it could pinpoint the wreck. Locals in Cartagena paid close attention to the vessel's comings and goings. My biggest fear was always that some of the banditos would think we already found the treasure, recalls Bob Smith, the U.S. Navy veteran who led the operation. We were shot at a few times. The third search phase took place aboard a civilian submarine called the Auguste Picard, built for the 1964 Swiss Expo to take tourists to the bottom of Lake Geneva. The Mesoscafe was named after the famous Swiss inventor and balloonist, an inspiration for both Star Trek's Jean-Luc Picard and the adventures of Tintin's Professor Calculus, and designed by his son Jacques Picard. In early December 1981, according to members of the crew, the side-scan sonar mounted on the Picard picked up a large ship-like anomaly on a ledge about 200 meters deep. The vessel returned to the site several times over the next few weeks, often resting on the seabed so the team could shoot video of the target or hide from nosy Colombian Navy submarines. After one such occasion, the crew surfaced to discover that a piece of wood from the site had been lodged in the Picard's propeller shaft. Subsequent analysis determined it was consistent with wood used in the construction of a late 17th century galleon, says Roy Doty, who served as the mission's archaeologist. This evidence was enough for Glacamora's investors to declare that they had found the San Jose. In early 1982, they reported the coordinates of the target, which they said was in the immediate vicinity of 10 degrees, 10 minutes, 17 north, 76 degrees, 0020 west. The head investor, a Chicago financier named Warren Stearns, who died in 2010, met with a Colombian government committee in Bogota to discuss how the treasure would be divided once salvaged. He had understood that it would be split evenly between Glacamora and the government. But when it came time to sign the paperwork, Colombia offered Glacamora only a 25% cut. Stearns refused. Perhaps believing it would give him a better negotiating position, he told his interlocutors that there had been an error in the reported coordinates, which put a very negative atmosphere on the meeting, recalls the Picard's captain, an even-keeled Englishman named John Swan, who was in the room. When they stepped out of the meeting and into a downpour in the streets of Bogota, an agitated Stearns told Swan to immediately demobilize the operation. A few days later, upon surfacing from a dive to recover the transponders they'd dropped on the seafloor, the Picard was intercepted by a Colombian gunboat and its crew arrested on what Swan believes was the trumped-up charge that they had no license to operate a submarine in Colombian waters. In 1984, Glacamora's cut was slashed even further when Colombia passed a law, applied retroactively, reducing the ownership rights of a shipwreck's discoverer down to 5% of the wreck's contents. By this time, Glacamora's stake in the San Jose had been taken over by a company called Sea Search Armada. Its CEO, Jack Harbison, has spent the last 35 years fighting the Colombian government for the rights to half the San Jose treasure in both American and Colombian courts. There's no doubt that they, the Colombians, are trying to steal the treasure, Harbison told the Huntsville Times in 1988. The value of what's down there could double Colombia's foreign reserves. In 2007, Colombia's Supreme Court ruled in his favor, declaring that the treasure didn't qualify as cultural patrimony and that Sea Search Armada was entitled to 50% of whatever was found at or around the reported coordinates. But the government has refused to allow Sea Search Armada to return to the area to verify the coordinates, threatening to use force. It's been just kind of a standoff, said Harbison, speaking from his home in Bellevue, Washington, in a Zoom session with surviving members of the expedition. At 89, Harbison continues to fight. Sea Search Armada has sued the Colombian government in U.S. courts and envisions further litigation. Harbison has taken up the matter with Congress, where it has caught the attention of, among others, Senator Robert Menendez, chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. It would seem that the debate was settled definitively when Colombia's Supreme Court issued its decision in 2007 in favor of Sea Search Armada's claim, Menendez wrote in a statement to Vanity Fair. If there is one thing I have observed over the last two decades of work with the Colombian government, it is that due to its turbulent past, Colombia is a country that values the rule of law and decisions by their Supreme Court cannot be ignored. The Colombian government, meanwhile, argues that since by Sea Search Armada's own admission the reported coordinates were incorrect, the Supreme Court's decision is irrelevant. There is no margin of error, said Camilo Gomez, the general director of the National Agency for the Legal Defense of the State. Harbiston has vowed to give a portion of the treasure, or whatever settlement he might receive instead, to indigenous causes in Latin America. Spain's gold and silver was taken from those who lived on the land before, he argues. I don't really have a plan, said Harbiston. I just said it's the right thing to do. Treasure hunters used to be seen as roguish heroes, dreamers, risk-takers, literal venture capitalists who spent decades in pursuit of unimaginable riches. But as maritime archaeology developed into a serious academic discipline, the glamour of treasure hunting waned. To call someone a treasure hunter today is essentially to call them a grave robber. I analogize it to elephant hunting, said James Gould, a lawyer who has successfully fought American treasure hunters in U.S. courts on behalf of Spain, forcing them to return millions of dollars worth of salvaged coins. It used to be something that people thought was really cool and dangerous, he said. Not so anymore. One major turning point was UNESCO's 2001 Convention on the Protection of the Underwater Cultural Heritage. The agreement aimed to prevent the plundering of shipwrecks and other archaeological sites that have been underwater for more than 100 years and prohibits the selling of salvaged artifacts. But until recently, Colombia remained open for business. The country never signed the UNESCO Convention, in part because doing so would have granted Spain ownership rights over the San Jose, as well as the hundreds of undiscovered colonial-era shipwrecks believed to lie in Colombian waters. The Santos government further defied the spirit of UNESCO's convention in 2013 by passing a law that allows private contractors to salvage wrecks and then keep up to 50% of the value of those objects that do not constitute the cultural patrimony of the nation. According to the law, artifacts, of which there are multiple interchangeable examples, such as uncut gemstones or coins of the same denomination from the same year, don't count as patrimony beyond the first few specimens. The rest would qualify as treasure, and the contractor could keep up to half of it. The law sparked outrage among a number of observers who saw it as sanctioned looting. The robbers are going to flee the bank, escorted by police, said Francisco Munoz, a Cartagena historian and self-appointed San Jose watchdog, in a recent interview. A former state's attorney named Leandro Ramos has referred to the law as a criminal plot. Others were more pragmatic, recognizing that Colombia likely didn't have the means to finance ambitious search and salvage expeditions on its own. Nevertheless, critics feared the ambiguity of the law, especially that up to 50% provision, would be an invitation to graft. I really didn't like that, because that opens the door for countries like ours that are prone to corruption, said Daniel de Navies McAllister, a nautical historian who helped shape the law but had lobbied for an even 50-50 split. De Narvaez says the law was obviously written with the San Jose in mind. And just 2 years after it passed, the galleon was found. More than 100 archaeologists and academics around the world signed an open letter, published in the Spanish newspaper ABC, urging the Santos government to ensure that any excavation be conducted with the strictest archaeological rigor and in total transparency, avoiding a debacle that keeps wealth in the hands of few. The longer the government went without revealing any details about Hemingway or his backers or their plans for the excavation, the louder the critics grew. Santos had hoped to see the excavation of the San Jose begin before the end of his presidency in August 2018. On July 23rd of that year, the day he was supposed to announce the public-private partnership to excavate the wreck, Santos returned to national airwaves to make a different, more regretful declaration. He was suspending the process. This was a far cry from Santos's triumphant first press conference 3 years before. The swagger was gone. Here was a man defeated but defiant. He attributed the decision to sustained activism by concerned citizens, to which he affixed a disdainful pair of air quotes. In hopes that his successor would restart the partnership, he at last introduced the nation to the discoveries of the discoverers of the San Jose, and made no mention of Sea Search Armada. The effort had been bankrolled by a previously unknown English company called Maritime Archaeological Consultants, or MAC. Though he didn't identify the principal financier, whom he referred to simply as the originator, Santos name-checked the search expedition's main participants, describing them as a dream team. They found the wreck, he said, with assistance and technology from the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute, the internationally renowned Massachusetts-based research organization that helped locate the Titanic. But the driving force behind the effort, the person who cracked the mystery of the San Jose, he said, had been an archaeologist named Roger Dooley. After the press conference, Santos played a short video documenting the search effort in 2015. The moment Dooley appeared on camera, it was clear. White hair, white beard, Hemingway. Dooley welcomes me into his 21st floor condo in Aventura, Florida, and shows off his spectacular view of the Atlantic Ocean, as well as the dazzling celebrity properties across the canal, including Lionel Messi's over to the right in Sunny Isles Beach. You'd be forgiven for taking him for a treasure hunter at first glance. It's not only the look, less Hemingway than Ancient Mariner, with deep-set eyes, flowing gray hair, and a scar on his hand from the bite of a moray eel. His walls are covered with yellowed maps and images of galleons. His shelves contain numerous books on treasure hunting. On his coffee table is a special edition of National Geographic All About Pirates. On a side table is a miniature treasure chest. Nevertheless, Dooley dispels the myths of treasure hunting. Gold coins were never kept in chests except in novels and movies. They were stored much more sensibly in small portable boxes. And X never, ever marks the spot, except that one time it did, on an old map he found of the Cuban coast that marked the location of an early 18th century shipwreck with a Maltese cross. Dooley, 76, says he has found more than 100 shipwrecks since the late 1960s, but insists that he's no treasure hunter, that he loathes the practice. "I'm an archaeologist," he said. "I have never found gold. I have never touched a gold coin. Most colonial-era coins were silver, but it doesn't seem like he's trying to get by on a technicality." He concedes that if there's as much treasure on the San Jose as many historians believe, he will have found more sunken gold and silver than anyone in history. The suggestion doesn't faze him. He has long been obsessed with the San Jose and seems more interested in the number of bronze cannons on the galleon. 62, he says, not 64, as is commonly reported, than the amount of gold, which he says is unknowable and only a small part of the story. Should Mac be granted the contract to excavate the San Jose, an undertaking he estimates between $70 million and $100 million, Dooley says he will not take any share of the treasure and would refuse it if offered. "I don't want to be rich," he said. "I'm never going to be rich. I just want to lead a nice, normal life. With my salary from Mac, it's enough." He pauses. "A Of course, they might give me a bonus, give me a gift. I don't know. What am I going to do, throw it away? Dooley speaks frenetically in a desiccated rasp with a thick Cuban accent that belies his childhood in Brooklyn. He never knew his father, who was of Irish descent. His parents divorced when he was an infant, and his Cuban mother remarried a Cuban man by the name of Montañez, who moved the family to Havana in 1957 and found work as night manager of the new Hilton Hotel. After forcing President Batista to flee the island on December 31, 1958, Fidel Castro and his Marxist rebels nationalized the Havana Hilton, which they considered a totem of capitalism, and renamed it the Havana Libre. It became the unofficial headquarters of the revolution. Castro took over a whole floor and occasionally snuck into the kitchen after hours. Castro loved to cook, recalls Dooley. Almost overnight, Roger Dooley, the Brooklyn teenager who spoke bad Spanish, became Roger Montañez, aspiring Cuban revolutionary. He says he trained to become a MiG pilot, but being American-born was deemed untrustworthy. Instead, he found his vocation underwater, becoming a skilled diver. The many shipwrecks he encountered inspired him to study marine archaeology. He matriculated at Cuba's Academy of Sciences and was soon representing Cuba at international conferences on underwater heritage. To Dooley's disappointment, Cuba lacked the resources to conduct proper excavations. In the early 80s, he went to work for a new government company called Carisub, whose raison d'etre was to extract wealth from the ocean, including by harvesting black coral for jewelry and prying treasure from colonial shipwrecks. It was at Carisub that Dooley made his first major discovery, a wrecked galleon called the Mercedes, which foundered a few miles east of Havana in 1698. He looked forward to conducting the first rigorous by-the-book excavation of a galleon in Cuban waters. But his boss, who, according to Dooley, considered the job as an opportunity to drink whiskey all day and feast on freshly caught lobster, had no interest in archaeology. He planned to use any means necessary, including explosives, to get to whatever gold or silver coins the Spanish might have left behind on the Mercedes. When he heard of these plans, Dooley flew into a rage. I said, "You know something? I quit," he tells me, and feels compelled to add that his former boss died years later, drunk, at his desk. But Dooley longed to know more about the Mercedes, to imagine the excavation that could have been. He flew to Seville, Spain, to the General Archive of the Indies, a notoriously labyrinthine trove of records dating to the beginning of the Spanish Empire. "You could spend 20 years there and not find what you're looking for," Dooley tells me. "It's not like there's a shipwreck section." While rummaging through bundles of paper, he chanced on a curious document, a sewn-together collection of letters about a different shipwreck, the San Jose. As he read about the dramatic circumstances of its sinking, he grew transfixed, and he began to believe he could find it. The task would involve almost 30 years of research in multiple countries. At the British Library, Dooley discovered a key source, a mariner's handbook, or Dertero, written by a pilot of the San Jose. While he did not take part in the galleon's final voyage from Portobello, Panama, to Cartagena, the pilot knew the route well. Dooley says the handbook, combined with meticulous study of winds, currents, and first-hand accounts of the battle, allowed him to map out 6 search areas in which he believed he had the likeliest intelligence, the highest likelihood of finding the wreck. Throughout the early 2000s, he hounded lawmakers in Colombia for updates on what would become the law of 2013, allowing public-private partnerships in the excavation of historic shipwrecks. When it seemed like it was on the verge of passing, he sought an investor to bankroll the search. The richest families in Colombia seemed like a good place to start. He showed his plan to a few and offered them the chance to sign their names to one of the nation's most enduring legends. After they politely declined, he considered the Mexican business mogul Carlos Slim, then the wealthiest person in the world, hoping to keep the financing in Latin America. No success. Finally, he found a willing backer in England. The originator is a phenomenally wealthy 40-something London financier who's as passionate about naval history as he is about guarding his anonymity. Dooley will say nothing about the originator except that he's a genius and has not balked at any cost. Together, they founded MAC in the early 2010s. With the sole purpose of finding and excavating the San Jose. While Dooley claims he doesn't want to benefit from the treasure, the same can't realistically be said about the originator. Yet the possibility of tremendous profit is not the only reason people invest in shipwreck salvage, nor is it simply about vicarious adventure or a love of history. Treasure hunting is an objectively terrible investment, with high operational cost and very low chances of finding the loot, let alone getting to keep it. That may be the point. In the likely event that an expedition fails, savvy financiers can sometimes write off the totality of their investment to reduce their taxable income. In 2012, British fiscal authorities investigated 129 people suspected of taking part in salvage-related tax avoidance schemes, including the TV adventurer Bear Grylls and billionaire hedge fund manager David Harding. Dooley steers the conversation away from any discussion of financing. Asked how many investors Mac has, he says he doesn't know and doesn't care to. It could be one, it could be four. With money behind him, Dooley was now ready to act. After failing to make headway with underlings in the Santos government, Dooley decided his best shot, perhaps his only shot, would be to win over the president himself. For that, he needed to leave a memorable impression. But he had an idea. A few years earlier, at the Library of Congress in Washington, D.C., Dooley had found a map of the Cartagena region from 1729 that contained a curious detail. In the general area where the San Jose was thought to have sunk was a grouping of islets labeled Bajo del Almirante, or Shoals of the Admiral. The name appeared on no other known map. Dooley was certain it was a reference to the English Commodore Charles Wager of the HMS Expedition, who had attacked the San Jose and whom the Spanish would have referred to as the Admiral. There was surely a connection between these shoals and the site of the battle, he thought. More importantly, it was just what you'd imagine an old treasure map would look like. He downloaded the map, cleaned up the image, had it framed, and in December 2014 brought it to a consular event in New York that he knew Santos would be attending. He waited all night for the opportunity to speak to the president and present him with the map. In the wee hours after nearly everyone had left, he got his chance. Dooley is vague about how the map helped him locate the wreck, but as a piece of theater it worked brilliantly. Santos was dazzled by the man with the white beard and arranged to have him meet with Colombia's Minister of Culture, Mariana Garces Cordoba. Within 6 months, Mac had his permit and Dooley began to assemble his team. Hired as a contractor, Woods Hole provided the search technology, but Dooley's closest collaborator was a veteran underwater surveyor, one he'd worked with before, named Gary Kozak. I gotta tell you, when I first met Roger, I thought he was a little bit of a crackpot, Kozak said. He was very flamboyant. My first reaction was like, man, I don't know about this guy. And then as time went on and I learned more about him, I realized this guy really knows a lot more than some people think he does. The search began in the spring of 2015 aboard the aging Colombian research vessel Ark Malpelo. Day after day, the Woods Hole crew released the Remus 6000, a torpedo-shaped autonomous underwater vehicle, AUV, mounted with a side-scan sonar, programming it to travel back and forth over a given area of the seafloor in a pattern called mowing the lawn. Then, Dooley and Kozak would peruse the sonar data for any anomalies. After several weeks, they had found nothing. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selection by Mark Hoffman.